The Loose Cannons Podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
Sorry, carrying on this way. I was beginning to lose faith in everything. And this happens and you want to believe all over again.
And believe too much. This is a ruthless world, and one must be ruthless to cope with it.
That isn't true. It's a blundering world, and a very sad one. Yet a little kindness can make it beautiful.
You'd better go before your philosophy corrupts me.
Hey, everybody. Another Loose Cannons podcast. Coming at ya, but with a different voice than usual. This is Basil instead of Ruben doing the intro because Ruben was having some horrible internet issues with his cable company, and so we're doing just a three-person podcast today. This will be the first time ever that I think that we've had two of the primary players missing because Patrick's still out on location doing major Hollywood movie making, and the aforementioned technical difficulties. So today it's just going to be me, Ilya, and Michael Duillo returning. Hey, Michael.
Hello.
Hey, Michael.
Glad to be
hey,
back
everybody.
On location at the Loose Cannon Studio, the back lot.
It's true.
Yeah, we are right. We are actually located inside the Earwolf Studios. Yeah. So we have this tiny little studio within the studio.
In a janitorial closet. They don't know we're here.
Which is why our audio is way worse than theirs. But yeah, thanks for flying out to Los Angeles all the way from Winnipeg to be on this podcast.
Yeah, no, appreciate it.
No problem. You guys didn't have to blindfold me on the ride over here, though.
The Earwolf Studios, it's a real big secret.
Yeah.
I remember very recently on Comedy Bang Bang, Horatio Sanz gave away the address and they bleeped it out.
Well, we won't blindfold you on the way back.
Yeah,
so, cool.
Yeah.
Just have to sign a NDA. Can't discuss anything that happened in the time between the end of this podcast and whenever you arrive back home in Winnipeg. So, today we're going to be talking about Monsieur Verdoux from 1947, directed by Charles Chaplin. It's my first experience with a Charles Chaplin talkie, so that'll be exciting to discuss. But obviously, before we do that, we're going to do some heralds and announcements.
Boop, boop,
boop. Nice, like a...
That was a deeper...
Yeah, like an oboe instead of a trumpet.
Yeah,
a bassoon.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I'll do...
Ilya's starting off.
Yeah. I'll take the first one, and I actually have a herald this time. And nice. It's a movie that I expect to make my top 10 list at the end of this year, and that's Beyoncé's Lemonade.
Yeah.
Ooh.
The critically acclaimed music video length movie, or movie length music video, rather. Yeah, I was really quite surprised. And taken by it. I was not a huge fan of Beyoncé before this. I really liked the last album she did, and really enjoyed this one. And I thought it was, you know, like a lot of people have said a lot of smart things about it already, and the way in that it speaks to and about let's say black female voices, and uses iconography from the Black Lives Matter movement, and incorporates Beyoncé's media persona as well as her, like, it was like home videos and things like that, splices that up and kind of makes a really interesting thing out of a kind of very, I don't know, boring media story about how Jay-Z cheated on her. And just explodes this in a way that makes it really, really interesting. Especially, probably most what I liked about it is the way that it kind of transitions from this like very to put a dumb word in it, kind of angry first part to a more mellow and let's say accepting second part. But then ends with Formation, which I really like because that kind of reminded me of how Do the Right Thing ended with the two quotes, the Martin Luther King quote and the Malcolm X quote. And where you could, if you can like make a comparison here, it would be the All Night would be like the, you know, let's be a family, let's be like, let's love each other and so on. But then Formation is again kind of a call to power, call to action, and kind of a something that kind of counter argument to All Night, and especially the way that kind of disrupts this structure, I thought was pretty cool and ends things on a much more interesting and kind of kind of more action filled note. Which I thought otherwise could be mistaken for kind of like, oh, well, Beyoncé was angry, but then, you know, now she's learned to love her man or whatever, but for all his faults. Mm-hmm. And I could talk a lot about how it speaks to masculinity and femininity and how, like, you know, how she speaks about her father and how that had maybe something to do with how she tries to explain things about how black masculinity works and modern black masculinity or masculinity in general works, and the role femininity plays in that and how they kind of inform each other. But again, I feel like the way it ends is really cool and really kind of made the whole thing work for me even more.
Nice. I like it also, but we have a lemonade dissenter in our midst.
Hello. I only finished like 15 minutes of it, and then I actually had to go to work, I think. But I don't know, I wasn't feeling it. Partly, I also just don't like Beyonce's music, so right away I just felt like I wasn't in the camp, so to speak.
In the demographic?
Yeah. So instantly I knew that I wasn't going to like it. And it's hard to separate, if you don't like the music, it's hard to separate it from any other context that the music is in. So partly it was that. So I think I also partly was just looking for reasons to not like it that are deeper than I just don't like it. But now maybe this is a little conspiracy-minded or truthery, but I don't know. Whenever I see something from Beyonce or Jay-Z, even if there is ostensibly a nobler purpose behind it, I just can't escape the feeling that there's trying to sell me something. Like, it just has the veneer of a capitalist exercise in selling you progressive ideas. And I couldn't escape that feeling, and it just kind of tainted the experience for me. And I think I was reading online already, there's Jay-Z has a response that he's formulating as an album or something, and it just kind of reinforced that feeling the other day. And I was like, of course there's going to be a response. You can't make the blockbuster without making the sequel to the blockbuster. Right? That's how things work these days. So I haven't finished the whole thing yet, so take that for what it's worth, but I just... it wasn't for me.
It's fine. You're Canadian. We'll just judge you as...
he just doesn't get it.
Yep.
Does that count as your denouncement?
No, I had watched that a lot. Can I also herald Blowout?
Oh, yeah.
I love movie. I hadn't seen it in years. And I rewatched it a couple weeks ago with Linda. And... yeah, I just love the things that that movie does. I love the things that Brian De Palma does with sort of quote-unquote cheesy effects and with, yeah, you know, sort of outdated or kitschy sort of style and effects and aesthetics and just the way he's not afraid to use them. And, you know, the weird angles, the different frames going across, the weird cuts and wipes. Just loved it so much. The one thing, though, that Linda was watching it with me, and she hadn't seen it before, and she had a really strong negative reaction to the end of the movie where they're using... spoiler alert, I guess. Yeah,
whatever, we don't yeah, care about spoilers.
For like a 30-year-old movie, I guess.
Yeah.
when they use the scream in that film that he's been working on throughout the whole movie, she had a really strong negative reaction to that. She, you know, that was not okay with her. Yeah, and I had never really considered it. I mean, I had sort of, but I kind of... My emotional reaction to that personally was always, oh, wow, that's so powerful and such a testament to, you know, the way John Travolta's character felt about the female character, that he would take her scream that as she was dying and add it into a movie to sort of memorialize her. And Linda and I had a sort of a short discussion about it, and she just felt that that was not okay. It was very, like, sort of gross feeling, which is kind of the Brian De Palma thing, though, too, to make you feel gross.
Gross feelings, yes.
Yeah. But
yeah,
it was, I just wanted to herald it because, you know, especially, I think that people should watch it with somebody of the opposite gender and talk about it after that movie, or any Brian De Palma movie. They should watch it with people of the opposite gender just to get the other side's perspective on it.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, that would be my required reading to send listeners home with. Find someone of the opposite gender and pick a Brian De Palma movie that you can watch with them.
Yeah,
and then
I feel like
go ahead.
With Brian De Palma, that's a really good point, because a lot of his movies definitely kind of speak to like a 13-year-old boy psyche within the viewer, I feel like. Actually, when you said that, that actually reminded me of how the reaction to her was kind of like that. And a lot of women that I talked to, they like really didn't like that movie. And a lot of men just fucking love that movie so much that it was interesting to me that a lot of the stuff that kind of, because that movie is all about like male fantasy and also like in a way, maybe while it's kind of an interesting take and very critical take on male fantasy, it's also just by and at large a kind of a vanity project about male fantasy. And so, but in by that, a little bit boring for someone that maybe is not interested in that like at all. And so I feel like that's another movie that I feel was very polarized by gender, which, I mean, not that many films. I feel like, I mean, you could have the boring arguments about like romantic comedies or whatever, and versus action films. But I feel like, especially with like critical darlings, there's also like these weird splits in perception.
Yeah, I think there's a few De Palma films that have kind of had that split. The like Dress to Kill,
yeah,
I think was one of them too.
Well, yeah, especially with an added element of transgender people watching that movie and fucking hating it.
Yeah,
for really good reasons.
And until relatively recently, that wasn't a consideration for most critics or most people in general. But
yeah. Correct.
What was I gonna say? Oh, yeah, my interpretation of the ending was more that it was like a masochistic decision, that he's like punishing himself for not being able to save her by forcing himself to listen to her dying over and over again. But either way, whether it's a nice gesture or a sad one, it still affected me. I will go ahead and denounced the first hour of Captain America: Civil War.
Boom.
Yeah, I will maybe eventually finish it once it gets to my theater so I can see it for free, but I walked in having had a few drinks. I was having sort of a crappy day, and I was like, I'm going to have a couple drinks, and then I was like, well, I'll go watch this Captain America. That'll distract me. And so but then I had another drink at the movie and started to really feel it about 20 minutes into the movie, and I was just like, I don't care about any of this. This is not a movie that I have any interest in where it's going. And then I started to feel a little sleepy and super bored, and at a certain point I was just like, I'm just gonna leave. Like, I don't care. It's just like over an hour of exposition of like different characters being like, it's messed up that he did that. Like, I don't know how I feel about that. And then the other character being like, well, we're just trying to do the right thing here. And then like, it just felt like they hadn't built up in the previous movies enough reason for like a bunch of superheroes to want to punch each other in the face, that they had to like spend a lot of time being like, this is what happens, this is how you get there. But I was like, I don't like, they're just manufacturing drama. Like, it doesn't feel organic or interesting at all. And then I don't know. From what I've heard, it gets better in the second half once they actually start punching each other, but that first half was a real chore to get through.
Well, that's a relief then that we didn't, because we were planning to maybe take that movie as one of this year's blockbuster movies and review it all together. Yeah. But that sounds like that would have been kind of a major waste of time for us.
I probably would have had to watch the whole thing, so
right.
It would have at least wasted another hour and 15 minutes of my time.
Sounds like.
Yeah. So let's get going with Monsieur Verdoux. Or Verdoux, I don't know.
Just before we did that, just real quick, since Ruben is not here, but he did let us know.
Oh, that's right.
His lone herald, his herald for this week would have been Damsels in Distress by Whit Stillman, a movie that me and Basil really, really like. And I don't know about if Patrick's watched it, but so far that's been kind of a favorite on this podcast.
It's a Loose Cannons approved.
So everyone who hasn't seen it yet, go see it.
And then go see Love and Friendship, which is coming out very soon.
Woo!
I'm so excited.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting.
Oh, that's fine.
That's all good.
Now on to Monsieur Verdoux. So it's my pick, so I'm going to do the plot, and then Ilya will say how he feels, Michael will say how he feels, and then I'll conclude with how I feel. So the plot is basically that Charles Chaplin plays the titular character who was a banker before the Depression, worked in a bank for 30 years, was very good at his job, but once the Depression hit, they started downsizing, and so he was cut, and he has a wife who's in a wheelchair and a son, and his scheme to continue supporting them is to travel around France and marry lonely old women and kill them and then take their money and invest it in the stock market in the hopes that he can make enough money to eventually retire and support his disabled wife and child and become the providing father that he was before the Depression hit. But then obviously... because movies are movies, you can't just like have a character make that plan and then it goes smoothly and then they just walk away into the murderous sunset together. So a series of escalating issues happen with Chaplin and eventually resulting in his imprisonment and execution. Yeah. Oh yeah. How did you feel about this movie?
I liked this movie. I don't think all of it worked, but I feel like the things that did worked really, really well. I'm still not quite sure what to make of Chaplin's performance in it, but I feel like the more I think about it, the more it makes sense. And I feel like if we start discussing and get a little bit more into kind of what I feel like the movie did well and did not so well. But yeah, I would give it a like 3.5 stars or something.
I did not like this movie. I didn't think the humorous parts were humorous. I thought the social commentary felt very forced and kind of almost like an afterthought, or like kind of shoehorned in. And yeah, but I did like Chaplin's performance, but other than that, no, I did not care for this movie.
I guess it's going to be 2-1, but which way remains to be seen.
Oh,
I actually did like this movie. I feel similarly to Ilya that there were certain parts that didn't work for me, but the parts that did, I thought were really, really strong and sort of carried me through the more bumpy parts. And I agree that the social commentary comes off a little didactic at the end, but that there was something sort of interesting about the stuff before that and its commentary on the way that capitalism is impersonal, and so we forgive its evils a lot more than we forgive like someone being personally evil and enterprising. So yeah, I guess we could get into it with that, and we should also add that Ruben, on top of offering his herald, said that he hated this movie, so we would have a classic 2-on-2 if he wasn't having internet troubles, but instead we get to bully Michael into our opinion.
Submission.
Hey, get ready, Michael. So, what would you guys like to start off? Should we start off with the bad parts?
Sure, let's talk about what work so well.
Yeah, so I definitely agree with Michael in saying that a lot of the on purpose funny things were not that funny. So I feel like a lot of the pratfall kind of jokes and humor were like really off. I definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was on purpose somehow, because Chaplin is obviously like a master of like physical comedy. So I kind of can't help but feel that there was some purpose to that. And maybe that goes with what I'm already going into, like what I thought was good about it. But like just the way that he kind of uses his persona or uses himself to kind of counteract the persona that people thought about him, and kind of just really inverts it and does like weird stuff with it. Like you keep expecting this to go a certain way. You keep expecting to laugh in particular in particular spots, but then you don't. And then like I laughed in a couple of spots that were really unexpected for me and like really weird. And so, but I would definitely agree that if he was really going for laughs with some of the physical comedy, then that really didn't work. My thought is that he wasn't. But yeah, I don't know what you guys think of that.
I think there is definitely an intentional playing with his persona that's very strange. Like, there's the part in the boat with like the lucky wife who like proves to be his undoing, obviously. Mm-hmm. Where he's like about to try and throw a rock over her neck, and like, and then she looks at him and he like backs away and does the like tramp smile where he like curls his body up and he does like the little like, oh, I'm just an innocent guy doing And like, yeah. Usually that's like cute in his movies, or at least in the past it was like played as like a cutesy character quirk, but like here he's like about to murder this woman, yeah, and like really we don't really want him to murder her, so like it's like a it's like a weird thing where it's like almost calling his persona into question, and like I think that plays in with, well, to get into something that I really like, there's like a part where he's talking with that woman who like he picks up the vagrant woman, and he's planning to murder her, and then he ends up having a conversation, and there's a part where she says, "You don't like women very much, do you?" And that almost feels like a like Chaplin admitting his own sort of like penchant for misogyny throughout his like silent comedy. Like a lot of his silent stuff had this weird air of like him either like punishing shrewish women, or just like this like very unbalanced power dynamic through a lot of his stuff that tended to get better as his movies went on. Like Modern Times, I think the woman in that is like a pretty strong character, and there's like kind of an equality to them, but that it felt like he was like, we're not supposed to agree with Monsieur Verdot in those moments, and I thought that that was like a pretty cool and interesting like way to have a character have a specific point of view that you feel like you're supposed to root for because it's Charlie Chaplin, but like what he says is so sort of like writing an awkward and like uncomfortable like mercenary line that you're like, I don't feel good agreeing with this guy.
It is very jarring though at the end when it seems pretty obvious to me, at least, that we're supposed to start agreeing with Monsieur Verdot once he starts becoming, for lack of a better word, a mouthpiece for Chaplin's own political views. Like, that switch is really hard to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think that we're supposed to be like, yeah, you're right, like, one murder is not so bad, like, who cares? Like, he's just doing what he had to do.
I mean, just in terms of, like, the anti-war, like, not that I disagree with anti-war sentiments or, you know, but not that the ideas that Chaplin had were bad in themselves, but it's really hard to sort of cognitively make that leap to hating or being disgusted with this person to intensely agreeing with them. It's kind of like the same problem you have in American Psycho, right? It's sort of very similar, right? It's like a kind of a horror black comedy kind of thing from a different era, but
the
character does very similar things, and then they start talking what we're supposed to see as sensible ideas, and it's really hard to make that flip to agree with this person who is being presented as either insane or a sociopath or some other, you know, disordered way of thinking.
I think that actually, well, what he does in the end is kind of, he spells out a lot of things that were kind of clear about Verdoux and as a persona already for me. Like, the guy just really, at some point, like, having worked as a bank clerk for like 30 or 35 years or whatever, how long, and like, hard to imagine a more like capitalist job than like being a bank clerk. You just really connected to like what makes capitalism work,
but
right?
Also still very really subservient in a way.
But at the same time, exactly. So he was kind of like a servant to the system, and so he knows exactly how the system works. And in the end, he just decides, oh, well, you know, I know how the system works. I also know how to make it work for me. He figures out how to enrich himself, although he didn't really need to. He just wanted to, right? So, like, there's a selfish element of that as well. There's that moment where his wife tells him, well, actually, we were doing pretty well. We were still pretty poor as long as we were together. And then he's like, don't you love this? Where are we at right now? And so on. So he, like, at some point decided he's going to actually make the system work for him. And he's really seen, like, through a lot of how things work. And so by the time that he's saying these things at the end, where it's not necessarily that I feel like that makes him a better person for having said those things. It's just he has such a clear understanding of how capitalism kind of works and makes, and the way like we perceive morality within capitalism in a very particular way, that I thought was pretty cool. I thought it was really interesting, and I thought that it made sense for him to say those things because that's what he was. He was this figure that really understood the system that he was in and made it work for himself.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar, that I think that for me, like, we're not supposed to say, oh yeah, you're right, or whatever. Like, we understand that that's the way that he sees it, but I don't think that we're supposed to absolve him of what he did so much as be like, hey, you were all hypocrites. I'm playing by the rules that you set up, where, like, capitalism's a mercenary system where collateral damage doesn't really matter, because if it did, you wouldn't be okay with, like, dropping bombs on people, but you're totally okay with dropping bombs on people, so why are you not okay with me, like, murdering these old women who, you know, like, I'm taking their money the same way you're taking these bombed people's money, like, how is it any different? But I don't think that we're supposed to be like, oh, like, what you're doing isn't as bad, he's just participating in a system that he's like, these are the rules, you set up the rules, I'm playing by your rules, like, why am I being punished for playing by these horrific rules that you set up for me?
Yeah, and the thing that I noticed that really doesn't make sense in the context of this movie being made in 1947, and maybe also just doesn't make sense in general, but for me kind of worked, is when he's about to get guillotined, right, executed, and then they offer him a cigarette, and he declines, which I thought was hilarious. And then they give him some rum, and he drinks it. And I was like, that's a great indictment of our culture's worship of alcohol and our now sudden hate for cigarettes, which, although that is fucking ridiculous because both of them fucking kill you really slowly. And how the fuck is one thing so much cool, so cool and worshipped and, like, whatever, and one thing now suddenly not a thing anymore, which I think is really funny now, like, the way that works and goes in line with this whole weird capitalist critique that this movie has. But obviously, you know, that's just a silly kind of take on that.
It's a perfect time to take a sip of a beer during that.
I'm teasing you guys, but no, the viewers can't see it. We can put in some Foley work.
That's true. You should have made a, like, real overdone commercial.
Some clinking ice cubes.
That's true.
Yeah. I feel like, oh, sorry, Michael, go ahead.
I was just going to say, though, it's odd, though, then, that one of the most, if not the only sympathetic character in the movie, the vagrant woman, becomes so entrenched within that capitalist system very explicitly. Because she gets married to, or is she married at the end to the munitions dealer? So, I mean, I guess that kind of fits in with the with what you're saying, Ilya, in that it's such an entrenched system that even pure people sort of become corrupted by the nature of the system.
What I would say is actually that it's not that they're not necessarily pure in the beginning, and they're not necessarily. What kind of is, I think, the point of the movie is that you kind of get successful, and that has nothing to do with what kind of a person you are. You just figure out how to play the system. You can still be kind of she's still like a nice person, you know, she kind of treats him really well or whatever. But like in the beginning, she has no idea what to do. and like he gives her some tools or whatever, like money, and then she kind of figures out things for herself. But like she, like the and she figures out that okay, well for her the way to survive here is to kind of, you know, like marry a guy who's in an ammunition or whatever, and so that mm-hmm. is her way of playing the system in some way, right?
Yeah, and then I think that this movie is like very cynical compared to something like Modern Times, which made right in the middle of the Depression has this sort of hopefulness that that like the New Deal and stuff brought, that like, hey, maybe we all can come together and figure out a way to like undo this like capitalist like bullshit system that we have, and like that like a, you know, a guy of low means and a girl of low means can like meet each other and fall in love and figure out a way to like semi-honestly like make a living for themselves, and that by 1947, which is only like 11 years later, Chaplin had become so disillusioned that he's like, oh nope, that's not how it works, like we'll just start a war and then, you know, like that'll improve our economy vaguely through like borrowing money and generating jobs to like go murder people, and that's like, you know, I mean, that there's like that very quick montage with the rise of Mussolini and Hitler, and the implication obviously that these people, like all, similar to Monsieur Verdun, like saw how the system worked and they're like, oh, this is how I get this system, and then they just went for it, and now they're the people in charge, and like we're following their line of thinking rather than the original line of thinking. Like, because Hitler was so extreme, everyone had to fall into what he was doing and like retaliate with killing people also, because there was no way to like stop him other than that. And that's like clearly, like, I think there's a sense of fatalism that Chaplin feels about that result, that like there was this optimism, this hopefulness that things could be better, but then fascists came along and exploited the system to such a degree, and people's hopelessness to such a degree, that they like created uber capitalism, and there was no way to fight it except for go back to like what we were doing before. And
yeah
feels, and very sad.
And the similarity is also probably that Verdun himself, what he does is basically he preys on certain people's weaknesses, mm-hmm. which like in some way when the Depression happened there was a lot of weakness to go around because people were just very easy to take advantage of. Mm-hmm. And in and of itself, if you want to make that comparison, that's just a much that the same thing happening on a much grander scale. But while those things are quite obviously for us connected with evil, capitalism does that in its own way, but on a scale that's much more difficult to grasp and with much less of a clear iconography to just point to and say this is what's wrong or whatever, right?
It's much more impersonal.
Right. Much more disparate in some way.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of interesting during the segment where he's like trying to murder the lucky wife or whatever, that it's like the working class person who
won the lottery
mucks it up for him. Like the maid like sort of bumbles around, and her bumbling actually saves the woman's life or whatever, and there's something I think intentional about this sort of hierarchy. And
yeah
I don't know, I think the anti-capitalist critique, it's difficult though in a movie like this where you have a movie that's almost solely focused on upper class people, and it you display a lot of their trappings of their wealth, and it looks pretty good in some ways, right? Mm. Like it's the kind of the difficulty of portraying something in media while at the same time trying to critique it at the same time, where just the act of offering it as a piece of media, kind of because of the way we interact with media, makes it almost an object of like fetishization or of appeal.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like the upper class life looks pretty good in this, like the cafe lifestyle, the going out at night, it looks good. And then,
I mean, I think that that's part of the point, though, is that like you can understand why Ferdoux would resort to this in order to achieve that, if he sees that as like the only way to make it happen for him, that there is something. Because I don't know, like, I think that it's obviously intending to write a line, because he could have cast himself as like the enterprising detective who's tracking down this murderer, but the fact that he casts like himself, like ostensibly the most likable like persona of the last 30 years or whatever, as the murdering Bluebeard guy, is intended to create this kind of dissonance within you where you're like, should I root for him? Should I not root for him? Obviously, he's doing bad things, but it's Charlie Chaplin. Similar to like Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window or Vertigo or whatever.
Or Henry Fonda in Once Upon a Time in the West.
That's true.
Except that one's pretty clear from the beginning.
Yeah.
Which, I also feel like on some meta level, him, like his persona being the tramp and that being associated with the lower class, there's some commentary going on with him suddenly being like completely in this other sphere, looking differently, talking also as in a big kind of clash with what his movies used to be, and also probably in some way reflecting a lot of Hollywood movies, which mostly deal with rich people, right? Like,
it is
kind even of, the movies, sorry. The Hollywood movies I love, they mostly deal with rich people, like, and only like a couple of them kind of figure to include the lower class in it somehow. But you know, classic Hollywood is also pretty glitzy and so on. So I do feel like there was something intentional going on there, but like Basil said, I feel like the way that it was portrayed, it was supposed to look good because Verdoux was really loving this part of his life, I feel like.
So you think that it was supposed to look good because it's a way of showing the things that he's trying to attain, and then show the lengths to which somebody might go to get those things, like those finer things in life, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that there's, I mean, especially with the structure of the movie, it calls it a comedy, but it seems like it's obviously more intended to be something tragic, where like from a structural level, the idea behind like going way way back or whatever, that a comedy, you start with like a buffoonish character and then by the end they're like the king or like some great stuff has happened to them, and that a tragedy starts the opposite way, where you take somebody who has a lot of things and by the end they've lost everything. And that's very much the structure of this. Like at the beginning of the movie, he's rolling his scheme super well. He's like going from wife to wife, killing them when they're getting in the way, and like stacking up money, and then by the end he loses all his money, his wife and child die, and he gets murdered. And that the idea behind the movie, I think, is to sort of argue that capitalism is so overwhelmingly powerful that a person who ostensibly comes from like a well-meaning background can be seduced into doing really horrible things, that like we don't have this free will that we think we have. We're just like pawns within a system, and that, you know, if pushed, almost everyone would do things they, not necessarily murder, that it's obviously like exaggerated, but that people will do things that on the surface they don't agree with just to support the system.
See, I don't know, maybe that's where we differ, though, because I don't think that he was a well-meaning person. Like, even if partly his actions are a result of having...
Before we see him, like, he's a banker for 30 years. He didn't steal money from the bank. He didn't embezzle. Like, he was living, for all we know, like, an honest life.
But then he...
And then...
Then he suffers some sort of egoistic injury or narcissistic sort of injury, and he flips into this, just becomes a total, like, a sociopath, right? So I don't know. Like, I feel like there's something underlying it in his personality that makes him not a very sympathetic person, because I don't think your average person would, even if you were a banker for 30 years, I don't think you would, most people would do this. And I think,
yeah, I don't think he would, I think he would argue the same thing, but I feel like he also says that with a guy with Verdu's tendencies that are maybe already inherent in him, capitalism just lets those, like, gives those, like, free rein. You could get away with a lot, and you know, obviously there was something in him probably that was, like, triggered at some point, but also the question is, would he have become this person if he had not lived in the system the whole time that kind of kept, like, you know, showing him that actually you're kind of useless to all of us, even though you've been doing, you're living ostensibly the right way, you won't get anything for that, you get fired for that, right? Like, there's nothing to gain. Like, so the only thing you have is, like, you have to fend for yourself, and, you know, to fend for yourself within the system means to also prey on people in some way. And, like, this is obviously, like, a more extreme version of that.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say that I think that it's an exaggeration on purpose for dramatic effect and for the story, but that, like, in a way, you know, all of us who are participating in capitalism are murdering people, like, incidentally or whatever. Like, I've got an iPhone, even though I know that, like, Apple's, like, horrible factories are, like, causing their workers to commit suicide because they hate working there so much.
All of the
still have that iPhone.
All of the equipment we're recording this podcast on.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, you know, I buy clothes from H&M every once in a while, even though, like, all their shit's made by children and Malaysia or whatever. Like, it's we're choosing to ignore the suffering that we're participating in versus someone like Verdu, who's just very directly being like, hey, I can cut out the middleman and make even more money by just inflicting the suffering myself, and then, you know, getting a lot of money versus, like, having convenient things.
Yeah, I think one of the things that kind of was made this movie interesting to me is that I kind of compare it to, like, Breaking Bad. So the way Breaking Bad starts is you see this guy, and he's like, well, he finds out his job is shitty, and then he finds out he has cancer, and then he gets fired, and then, like, all his other shit, and then, like, his brother-in-law is an asshole and whatever. And, like, he was basically being told the whole time, well, you be a good person and then whatever. Like, good things will happen, and then they didn't, right? And then he decides, I'm going to take things into my own hands, and I'm going to use what I can to enrich myself. And there's, like, and then he does it a certain way. But the way that we get to know him in Breaking Bad is we first get to know him as this, like, basically decent dude who's then, like, who at first you're, like, supposed to, like, root for in some way. Whereas if you take the same story here and Verdu is this guy, all of that is, like, you find out about his bank thing, like, kind of 20, 30 minutes into the movie when he's in that cafe. The first thing you actually hear about is all these people talking about how, oh, this girl and her husband, and he's embezzling her probably. And then, like, you find out that, like, he's a murderer. And those are the first things you find out about him. And then you find out, oh, well, there was all this reasoning. So I feel like Chaplin actually goes not necessarily for the sympathy angle here from the beginning. Like, he actually shows you, like, the pure, like, the thing that this guy is right now, what, like, this, his, or what his life has made him, right? Mm-hmm. And then it kind of like shows you, well, there is some like humanity in him also. Mm-hmm. Like, but like it goes at it from a totally different way. I thought that that was interesting to compare it to something like Breaking Bad, which was so acclaimed for how it like showed you how basically this wore this guy down, then he became this monster or whatever. Obviously much more, whatever, more, maybe more complicated than that. But still, I feel like those two things, there's some similarity there, but different ways in how they arrive to the same thing.
Yeah, less of a sympathetic feeling and more aiming for, I guess, empathy with the character, at least, like an understanding of why.
Mm, yeah, I feel like the movie is definitely interested in that. It does seem to want you to understand why he does things. It doesn't want you to like him necessarily, mm-hmm. but I feel like it is really interested in why people do certain things. Mm-hmm.
And I think that the conversation that there's a really cool moment where they're talking about the world, him and the vagrant woman, and he says that it's a ruthless world, and to survive in it, you have to be ruthless. And she says that it's a blundering world, and she says some other stuff about, like, you know, everyone's just kind of wandering around, like they're essentially trying to do their best. And I think that the movie comes down on a more cynical side. But I think that she sort of represents at least like a feeling that I think maybe Chaplin used to have. She feels very much like the characters of the, and I mean the fact that she's a vagrant similar to the tramp or whatever feels like maybe like that's like how he felt in the era of City Lights of modern times, that there was something like hopeful about the world and that Verdú in a way almost represents how he feels now, that like fascism was such a crushing thing that like, and I mean the fact that the movie takes place in France can't be an accident, like the country that was like stomped by Germany and is at this point, you know, when he made the movie, like still like desperately in need of like help to recover from the Vichy government and everything else. But so like you can see the ways in which I guess France was like undone from the inside before the Nazis even took it over in 1939, because this whole movie takes place in the 30s.
Yeah.
So it's like before
just around the time, I guess, in the early 30s, just before Hitler and Mussolini, I guess.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think
it's. I feel like it's just before the Depression starts, right? Just before the Great Depression starts.
But doesn't he mean?
Well, the Depression starts in
29.
I guess it's spread it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, like it starts in the 30s after the Depression has started, but before all the banks are folded, because the banks all fold in like 32 and 33, and that's when like,
it's already really awful. It's already started to get bad at the beginning of the movie, I think, because he's calling the stockbroker, and they're talking about how he's constantly losing money, and but he also does mention very early on that the Depression is a thing that exists, that's on people's mind. So I think early 30s.
Yeah, I think that at the end of the movie it's like 32 or 33, which is when all the banks like officially collapsed, and that was like the really awful part of it was you know, they the stocks were like worthless pieces of paper.
One thing that's kind of unrelated to this, but it was reminded of Chaplin the himself in this movie when that his kid showed up, when the first time you see his kid and he's like, "Daddy," and you're like, "Shit, that looks weird that he's his father. He's so much older than this kid." And then and then in real life, Chaplin was like, what, like 80 or whatever when one of his wives had a kid or something.
That's true. Yeah.
There's some like weird things going on in this movie about like Chaplin's persona and Chaplin himself
and his age
also, like and his age,
and they're always commenting on it in the movie, which is also very strange and sort of like self-aware that he does have this young wife who's like disabled, but that all the other people are like, I mean, he's going after mostly older women, and even though some of the older women are like, oh, you're pretty old for me or whatever. Like, so like they're constantly commenting on like how old he is, which I feel like is a thing that doesn't happen now. Like Tom Cruise can be like in a movie with whatever, like 28-year-old woman, and they're not like, aren't you a little old for her, 55-year-old man?
Like, oh, but not the other way around, though.
Of course.
Yes.
But.
Yeah.
But I think that that's still sort of, like, an interesting thing. Even back then, I don't know, yeah, like, Jimmy Stewart's, like, 60 or whatever in Vertigo, and he's supposed to be, like, college chums with, like, that... that woman who has a big crush on him, like, they went to college together. I'm like, no way they went to college together. He's your dad.
Like, or in Rear Window, too, he's like, how old? He's like, he's got the silver hair, and she's...
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It's pretty gross.
Yep.
But just going back to the wife and the kid for a second, I thought it was kind of odd how they were... They were only in that one scene, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They never come back.
That was one of my problems with the movie, though, too, where there was a lot of characters that were introduced very briefly. Like, it just didn't... It felt unfocused. Like, I don't know if that was maybe intentional on his part, because he was going for maybe a broader look at... like what you guys are saying, this capitalist critique, but it just, as a movie to me, it just felt very unfocused. Like the wife and the kid were obviously meant to be sort of sources for empathy or with this character, but they were so briefly introduced into the movie that it just, for me, was, I didn't feel like it got the feelings across that it was maybe intended to.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it rides a line, though, because if you keep playing it up, then it would make him too sympathetic, where you're like, he's doing all these awful things, but he's doing it because he has a disabled wife. Like he's got to take care of her or whatever. And so, I mean, I agree that it's weird that they never come back, and then, like, we find out they died just because he says it in, like, a line, but...
Because he killed them, probably, right?
I don't think so.
I think because that's probably me having read, like, a little bit about how... What this was based on, and this was based on, like, a serial killer who killed, like, a bunch of ladies, older ladies, and, like, stole their money. And then he also killed, like, a dog and a child or whatever. And I'm like, oh, well... Maybe that's like, maybe he actually, because why did they die suddenly? What happened? Like, it feels weird.
Wasn't there some talk from one of the bankers that he was going to lose his house or something like that? My thought was just that they ended up on the streets and just starved to death or something.
Yeah, that was they
what I thought, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, I feel like it would be a stretch just because, like, other than the scenes with the vagrant woman, the only time he seems genuinely affectionate is in that scene. So
it'd be
a pretty big stretch for him to like be like, well, we're out of money, so I'm going to murder you now because I'll be putting you out of your misery or whatever. Like, I feel like you can't not have that scene in the movie if that's the implication. Mm-hmm. I thought that it was definitely like,
More
like he couldn't pay the mortgage and then... to go.
Maybe they left him or something. That's also
that could be
thing. Lost is, you know, could be mean lots of different things for sure.
It wouldn't really fit with his character. Like, his character really only kills for financial gain. It would be odd for him to switch when there's really probably no financial gain to killing this disabled woman and child.
Yeah, like the only person we actually see him kill is the police detective, right? And then even then he like basically kills himself or whatever, so like there's very few scenes like where we actually see him doing like something really really evil. Like, he's about to, but like never finishes the job usually, or it happens off screen like with some of the women that he deals with, right? So I was probably still, there were probably still limits to how far Chaplin was willing to compromise his very beloved persona, I think.
Yeah. Even though, and I think that it's part of his like overall plan for the movie is that he's supposed to ride a line, and like if he went too far in either direction, then it would like undo the sort of like dissonance or whatever. So if he's just like murdering people constantly, a la Patrick Bateman or whatever, it would be like harder to like feel the Chaplin-y like, oh, but am I supposed to like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Like, he still had a public image to maintain to some extent, though I think it was probably not as great as it had been previously.
By then, not so much.
Yeah.
I can't remember. I think I read that this movie was a flop. People didn't like it. But, I mean, yeah, like, the poster and stuff like that is all, like, it's playing that up quite a bit or whatever. Like, it says something about, like, the one where Chaplin murders or whatever, something. Yeah. It's like Chaplin the murderer, but something like that. I forget exactly what it says.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if people went in there expecting like a Charlie Chaplin movie, I'm pretty sure I get why they were pretty upset. Disappointed, because, I mean, for me, actually, this was pretty weird. Like, I haven't watched a Chaplin movie in quite a while. And now watching this was like really weird. Like, I think it's just has nothing what you're kind of supposed to expect, or been taught to expect from his movies.
Yeah, I would say the one visual gag that did work for me was him jumping the fence to escape the wife to like leave when his other wife is also there, mm-hmm. and then he just says goodbye and just runs and jumps over the fence.
The one that got me was towards the end when the that first family that was talking about their dead relative at the very beginning, when they are chasing him and he kind of fakes the sun out and he runs through the door still and he locks it. I thought that was pretty good. It was one of the sort of like the smoother scenes where the physical movements actually worked really well. I thought it was like a lot of the, just the way everything was kind of blocked and the way the movements were staged and just the way things were edited. The physical comedy didn't really work because a lot of it was just scenes of him running and just kind of flailing his arms or I don't know if it's maybe just that the film techniques hadn't caught up with the humor, or the humor had kind of aged not well as film techniques had changed. But a lot of this sort of slapstick humor that Charlie Chaplin did, I find is funnier when people are, one, not talking, and two, when they're moving kind of at a sped up pace.
Right.
So I don't know.
I mean, I didn't...
Yeah.
I sort of am on Ilya's side that most of it, I don't know, like, I think that he wasn't trying to make it, because again, if he does too much like tramp like stuff, then he'll be too charming and it'll sort of like undo a little bit of what I don't know, like, because some of the directorial decisions I thought were really smart. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a part where like when he's first pouring the drink for the vagrant woman, mm-hmm. and whether or not she's gonna drink it, it's just like silent. There's no music and they don't talk for like 30 seconds while she's like eating and he's just staring at her, and I'm just like, this is really uncomfortable. Like, I don't like there's no drama of like the music swelling up or like dun dun dun, we're like getting close. Like, it's just like sitting and stewing in this like guy maybe about to murder some random innocent woman who's like done nothing but be super nice to him.
And he wasn't even really making any expressions or doing much with his face either. He was just staring, I think.
Yeah, like staring at her drink.
It was actually really creepy. Sorry.
Like, that sort of, that kind of goes against like him even having the idea of murdering her. Like, why would he have done that if, like, his whole thing is going after financial gain if she has no money?
Oh, they talked about it earlier. where like the guy when he's at the party and he gets the idea for the poison, mm-hmm. the guy's like, oh, and it's totally untraceable in animals, but I don't know for sure, like human physiology is a little different, like maybe it is traceable. And so Chaplin has this idea to murder a vagrant person, because then they would do an autopsy, and if like the news came out, oh, this vagrant was poisoned to death, then he'd be like, oh, maybe I can't use this poison after all, because they'll catch me.
Yeah, and I think that idea came from the friend, right? The chemist, or the Maurice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an odd thing for somebody to just bring up at a dinner party. Oh, well, you could try it out. You could kill a hobo and see how that works.
But he covers it up pretty well by being like, ah, but we'll leave that to the murderers.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like people talk about morbid stuff pretty often at parties and stuff like that, especially people who deal in sort of morbid, I don't know.
Like, also, chemistry is morbid.
It can be if you're cooking up poisons.
Yeah.
Early on in the movie, he just walks into a pharmacy and buys a bunch of chloroform. No problem.
Yeah, right next to the cafe. And he just like, 2 ounces of chloroform, please. And he's like, sure, no problem, sir. Here you go. What the hell else do you do with chloroform except put it to people's faces?
I don't know. Like, people used it as a sedative or something, maybe? Or an anesthetic? I don't know.
I feel like in movies, it's never been used for anything else.
Having some trouble sleeping, I'll just sniff my chloroform rag and go right to bed. Yeah, I mean, I think that I said everything that I had to say about this. I don't know if anyone else wants to bring up any other. I mean, I could get into some other small nitpick stuff, but
doesn't seem. Yeah, I mean, like, visually, this movie was pretty kind of mostly boring, I thought. Like, not that much going on. So that's definitely could be, like, a point of critique.
There were a lot of good hats, though. I know you guys have your hat.
Oh, yeah.
The hat game was
the
excellent.
Hat talk, yeah. We haven't had good hats in a while.
It's true. There were quite a few of them. Yeah. I'm reading Infinite Jest, and there was a part where everyone had to go to this party and wear a hat, and there's an end note that describes every single person's hat. It's pretty enjoyable. Some solid hat work. Good job, 1947. All right.
Yeah, well, I'm good, I think, with...
Yeah, thanks again for being on the podcast, Michael.
No problem.
Thanks,
my
Michael.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it was fun. All right, and for everyone else, if you enjoyed listening to the podcast, or if you've enjoyed listening to any of our podcasts ever, you should subscribe to our podcast and bulk up our numbers and give us those 5-star reviews that... make us feel really good. Like, they make us feel validated as human beings.
Yeah,
so
make us not want to go on murderous rampages.
That's true.
Make us feel...
we can defeat capitalism through 5-star reviews.
Exactly.
So make it happen, people.
Yes, listen to the
podcast. Yep, and go to our website and contribute to the discussion. And, yeah, loosecannons.net. You can read all our reviews that are getting pretty stale at this point. I've been meaning to write some more and haven't. I apologize. I'll probably get on that at some point, or I won't. No promises. But, yeah, so thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you very soon with our 100th podcast. It's going to be a big special 100 canon episode that'll be pretty sweet, but next week will be 99, so we're counting down. We're almost there. See y'all later. Thanks for listening.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.